on this very beautiful summer's evening here in Mundanoon. It's New Year's Eve tomorrow, so I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of New Year and give some reflections on that. And of course, New Year being a calendar convention, we reach the end of one year and then come round to the next. Happens all the time, and in a sense it has no meaning, it's just entirely a convention that's been adopted. But in a way that as humans we invest our conventions with meaning. Sometimes this happens in a excessive or irrational way. For example, the kind of silly apocalyptic scenarios around the 2012 kind of thing. And so there we get a lot of people take these things very seriously, and it's just a calendrical change. More normally, or more rationally, we take that change in the year to be something which we can use as a springboard or as an occasion to initiate positive change. So we want to do something. So that's why the idea of a New Year's resolution. We want to, there's something about ourselves we're not happy with. So we want to leave something behind in the old year and move forward into the new year. And that's quite a skillful little thing to do. We're kind of leveraging the power that that convention creates in order to bring about some positive change. Now, in terms of being a shift, the new year, as well as sort of marking a conventional calendar date, is in a sense it becomes a reality which shapes how things actually take place. We actually plan our lives according to a year. We have a 5-year plan, or we think we'll get this university course finished by the end of this year, or something like that. So we're actually creating our reality and our world in order to accord with the conventions. The conventions themselves are intrinsically meaningless, but we give them that meaning through the decisions that we make. And that time, that New Year time, is essentially a time, it's like the nexus of death and rebirth. And this is something which is figured very literally in pagan religions all around the world that we've been discussing the last little while, about these kind of festivals and ceremonies that they have. And so very often you'll have a ceremony where the old year is actually personified as a person who will then be burnt. So that might be done by making like a straw man, like a Guy Fawkes figure or something like that, and then burning them to signify the death of the old year. And then there may be a ceremony to symbolize the birth of the new year. And so in this way, that as usual, religious customs will use symbols and ritual in order to make these abstract concepts vivid and meaningful in the lives of people. Now, originally, this festival or this time was arose out of a natural cycle, and of course, in Europe, this time of year is the middle of winter. So this is when everything is dead. Life is at its most dormant, covered in snow, the leaves all fallen from the trees, the animals, many of them hibernating or keeping very quiet, and people for the most part being shut up in their houses, and the crops aren't growing, and it's really just a period of like waiting, suspension in between time, and waiting for those first new buds of spring to appear. So that this New Year time, even though it's a festival, is really a festival of death. In Australia, of course, it's kind of different, but funnily enough, almost the same in some ways, because even though we're now at the height of summer and the plants are growing quickly, but still in Australia we get used to this, the brownness of things. All of the grasses have died away, and so when we look around at our environment in Australia in midwinter, we can also see this as a time of death, which is looking forward to the rains of autumn that will bring it to life again. So even though we're kind of divorced by it from the natural cycle that this convention was based around, by a lucky coincidence in Australia we can still find some kind of meaning for it. Now, of course, this kind of festival is celebrated all over the world, and in every different place will be celebrated differently and at a different time of year with different means by different peoples. But in all cases, it is a way of keeping in touch and reminding ourselves, marking those cycles of nature. So the nature of our global culture as it has evolved over the last several decades, and indeed since the time of colonialism, is that these local customs tend to be lost in place of an international culture. And so we'll celebrate this new year at the same time as many people all around the world will be. And so the means of cultural transmission is no longer the inheritance of locally embodied knowledge through the personal elders of the tribe or the community, but is mediated through media and commercial interests who create and maintain these things in different cultures all around the world. And it's become abstracted, it's cut off from its roots, it's cut off from the reality of nature. So that's the bad side. The good side is that we get to have holidays from all different cultures. So that's good. We get to have Chinese New Year as well, and then there's Thai New Year and so on. So you get to have a lot of New Years during the year. So that's the good part of it. But I really like this idea of the killing, the murder of the old year. It has to be completely burnt. And this is something which traditionally was a highly embodied knowledge within, I think, virtually every culture or every culture I've been able to study or to look at. The ground, according to the indigenous Australians, the ground, the bush, needs to be burnt from time to time so it can find renewal. In the crop growing ceremonies in Europe and so on, they would literally embody the crop in a person or a deity who would then be murdered, like the green man that was sometimes called, many different ways it was done in different cultures and customs. And so the ending of the old needs to happen before the new can emerge. And the time of New Year is the time that sits on the cusp. And so one of the deities associated with this, of course, is Janus. And Janus being the basis for the name of the month, January. And Janus being a god who had two faces, one facing to the front and one facing to the rear. So this being this idea of sitting on the cusp, facing towards the past and the future. Now from a Buddhist perspective, Janus is a god who's very out of touch with reality, because Janus is entirely concerned with the past and the future and not actually watching the present. So this is a kind of another interesting idea, that Janus himself is cut off from the actual reality of experience, because he's totally caught up with these cycles, the death and the rebirth. Now death and rebirth and change are things which, according to the Buddha, are the very nature of being itself. So the Buddha didn't agree with the quest, the philosophical or metaphysical quest, to locate existence, to locate our deepest understanding of the nature of our world as we experience it, in the hypothesis of some underlying or really existing substance or substrata. He didn't reduce the world and say, well, it's all built out of ultimately atoms or something like that. He could have done. The theory of atoms was known in the time of the Buddha. He could have said that theory. He didn't. He didn't agree with the monistic theories of the Upanishadic Brahmins, who believed that the Brahman itself was the underlying metaphysical unity from which the apparent diversity of the world emerged. And he didn't agree with that idea either. And in fact, he called these the two extremes. Sabban ekatang ayang eko anto, sabban danatang ayang dutio anto. To say that everything is, I think it's the other way around actually, to say that everything is a multiplicity, everything is diverse, Sabang Nanatan. This is one extreme, to say everything is oneness, Sabang Ekatan. This is another extreme. So we don't either reduce the world to a kind of a plurality of existence, whether that be atoms or subatomic particles or whatever we want, nor do we reduce the world to, we say the world is ultimately just one kind of spiritual substance, one kind of Brahman from which everything manifests, kind of divine ground of being or something like that. These are two extremes as far as the Buddha taught. So what the Buddha looked at, the nature of being, the nature of existence, he said, well, the nature of existence is change. It's not, the nature of existence is not in some substance which we can look at, which somehow undergoes change, but it's the change itself which is fundamental. And this is a very, very profound insight. So that this notion of the change from the old year to the new year, it's from that very fact of that change that actually our notion of years and our notion of time can be. So please have a think about this idea. There's two different ways of looking at this. One way of looking at it is that of the year and so on, is to think that the year is actually something. The year is actually made up of something. And our New Year festival is a convention which we use to describe that existent something. That's one way. But I think that's what Buddha would say is one of the extremes. So what the Buddha points out is there's no such thing as a year. A year doesn't exist in a sense. What we observe is change. We observe the change of the seasons. We observe the changes of nature, the changes of night to day, the changes of the leaves falling off the trees, the changes of the temperature. We see the changes happening, the dying and aging, the rebirth of things. The change is what we actually see, and the cycles are what we see. There's no thing that changes, but the changes itself is what we see. And so the convention of New Year, and under that understanding, is not something which is a marker on an existing thing, but in a sense it creates the very idea of a year. The idea of a year is created from the fact that we can have a new year. The new year isn't a label we stick on an existing year. We create the idea of a year by inventing the convention of an old year which dies and a new year which is born. But in creating that convention, all we are doing is making vivid and practical the experienced reality, which is actually simply the reality of change itself. Now that change, which is the very substance and essence of our existence, that change happens constantly, and it happens through many different layers, which in some ways are a bit similar to like the layers or strata of rocks, with like the bedrock that's been down below. It's been there for the longest time, and then subsequent layers added on top, and then the top layer is in its process of being formed. It's just dirt and it's moving and shifting all the time, gradually getting more solid as it goes down. Something a little bit like that. That image is a little bit too static, or it's much too static, but it gives you some idea of these different dimensions to how change happens. And on the surface, the most obvious, we have this the shortest change that we have. If we look into our minds, you close your eyes now, look into your mind, what's happening now, you can see like almost like a fuzziness of things. There's this sparkle or speckle, a bit like the fuzz you see on a television when when there's no channel tuned into it, or the white noise that comes through a radio when it's not on the right channel. And it's just like the fuzz, the background fuzz of existence, which is constantly vibrating. And that's one of the fastest aspects of change. A slightly slower aspect of change might be a change in consciousness as we see things and hear things, and those things maybe last for a second or two, and they're changing. A slightly longer thing may be thoughts, which we can sort of maintain a sort of consistent thread of thought for a sort of certain period of time. Of course, it's changing within the thought itself, but there's still some kind of unity to that for a period of time. And then something longer again, so maybe like an emotion which will last for a period of a few minutes or a few hours or something like that. And maybe change slowly during that period, but it still keeps its sense of identity over that period. And underneath that is, again, things that will last for longer, like personality traits, habits that we pick up. And then underneath that, then there's like the bedrock levels of the basic sense of identity, the core sense of self, which we hold on to through the process of rebirth for life after life. So there's these different layers and strata of our being, all of them changing within themselves and also changing in their relationship to each other. So that this is a constantly evolving and very complex situation. Now, when we sit down to meditate, we practice present moment awareness. We are watching, like, if we come from that perspective of time, okay, of the past and the present and the future, we say be in the present moment. We say forget the past, forget the future, only concentrate on the present moment, as if the present moment is a slice of reality. That reality is like a river that's flowing. And we cut one slice of that river, and we keep our awareness on that one slice, that one point. Or maybe a better simile would be to say we put a marker in the river, we put a post there, and we just watch that post, and we watch the river flowing past it. So that's how we can imagine a metaphor in our mind to describe that process of time and the unfolding of things. It's like a river. But that itself is far too substantial to really represent the reality of what's happening. The reality is that there's no river. And the reality is that all we actually experience is this present moment awareness. And the reality is that the past and the future are merely inferences that we've invented to explain to ourselves what this present moment is and how to deal with it. This present moment that we're experiencing is present. It is presented to your consciousness. There is a mind within. There is a sense of awareness which dwells within, located, feeling itself to be located inside your body, and which feels itself to be watching the world spread out before it. And that sense of awareness, watching the world spread out before it, is happening only in the present moment. It only sees that change as it unfolds. Now, one of the things about consciousness which is very interesting is that consciousness will only notice change. You can see that in a very simple way. We're all sitting here in a group, and if somebody's sitting still and they don't move, you don't notice them. If somebody moves or somebody coughs, you notice that. So we notice the change. Our mind is drawn towards that. But that fact, we think of that as being a fairly trivial observation in psychology. But it's really much more than that. It's much deeper. That's just a surface manifestation of a much deeper truth. And that much deeper truth is that consciousness can only ever be aware of change, because this is the nature of existence itself. When there is no change, there can be no consciousness. The nature of consciousness itself is change. So any notion of consciousness being constant or still or not is always a relative notion. And this is the thing that we start to explore when we go into deeper meditation. We say, be in that present moment. We say, dwell on that cusp of the unfolding wave of reality that emerges out of the darkness and the mists of the past, and which rolls on into that unknown future. And we dwell on that cusp, and we take that act of courage which says we're not going to divert ourselves into speculating and worrying about what's come out of the past, because we can't do anything about that. And we're not going to run off and deal with all those things happening in the future, because the future will take care of itself. What we take that act of courage to say, we are just going to be here and dwell in this very present as it unfolds before our awareness, in our awareness, is our awareness. And this is the essence of the meditative quest. Now, as we do that, initially we find it very difficult. Initially we find that the mind wants to go off. It wants to go into the past and the future and so on. And this very fact is the essential reason why all of the great meditation methods initially focus on mindfulness of the body. Because awareness of the body, awareness of the five physical senses is always in the present moment. Only the mind can take us into the past and the future. We cannot see with our eyes the past and future. We cannot touch with our body the past and future. We can only think, imagine, remember, project, plan, regret in the past and future. So our mind is the one that invents and creates that. So if we come out of that mind consciousness into physical consciousness, immediately we're in the present moment. You feel that now. Touch something. We touch whatever, our own finger, our own cloth. That is the present moment. And it always and forever will be, and only that is the present moment. So when we're starting meditation, this is why we ground ourselves on that physical sensation. This is how we get in that present moment. That's how we stay there. We anchor ourselves, we ground ourselves. We refuse to be caught up in this mist of the past and the present, past and the future. And there's a concreteness to that. Now, in a philosophical or in a doctrinal sense, this then became controversial. According to the Theravadan school of thought, the present moment really, truly, really exists. This is called the Subhava. It has a Subhava, which is exists in the present, and the past and the future do not exist. That's the official Theravadan doctrine. Some of the other schools differed in that. And Nagarjuna famously criticized this idea and argued that the notion of something truly woolly existing or inherently existing was in itself incoherent and impossible, and the present didn't exist in any sense that the past and future didn't. Other schools came to different conclusions about that. The Sarvasivadins, of course, believed that the past and the future exist just as much as the present does. And so for them, the specialness of the present moment wasn't to be explained by the fact that the present moment exists, it was to be explained by the fact that the present moment is efficacious. It has a causal power to it, to actually create that spark of consciousness. This was the Sarvasivadin's explanation of this. So while the different schools of Buddhism differ in their explanation, their philosophical or theoretical explanation of this notion of the time, the past, future and present, they all agreed that in some way this present moment is special and is of prime importance in the development of meditation. That is unquestioned, that's agreed. The only problem is, how do you philosophically define that? How do you describe that in a way which is philosophically coherent? And it's not an easy thing to do, but something we intuitively can pick up, and that intuitive knowledge is all we need as practitioners. There's something special about that present moment which is not found in the past and the future. And so being on that cusp, just like here on New Year's Eve, we're on the cusp between the past and the future. That past has been combusted. It's burnt up. It's ashes. Everything that's been done there is gone. And what we have in the future is what needs to be, constructed. There are patterns which are discernible within our own heart, which are the patterns of intention and will and volition and planning. And these patterns indicate the direction that we at least want to go in the future, whether we can achieve them or not. Remains to be seen, but the patterns, the intentions that we have, are discernible in some way in the present moment. So when we have this, we reflect on this complex notion of the past, the present and the future, on these different kind of levels and different kind of scales, all of them relative and all of them interacting, then we begin to see some of the complexity and depth that is being presented to us in that present moment when reality occurs to us, and how we make sense of that. Now, the first thing that kicks into play that will, in a sense, start to drag us out of that present moment is the use of language and the use of concepts. And it's a very, very important point, and we need to all consider and understand this very well. When reality is presented to the mind, when sheer, raw, conscious data is passed through the eyes or the ears or the nose or the tongue or the body, our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue and our body don't know how to make any sense of that. They don't understand that or interpret it any more than a camera does, or any more than a microphone understands sounds. They're merely passing on that information. The understanding of that information, the making sense of that information, happens within the mind. And the mind does that through forming concepts. Now, that formation of concepts in its initial stage is what we call sanya. And sanya is what groups and categorizes and organizes the data of experience so that our mind can make sense of it. Sanya by itself is pre-linguistic, but it forms the basis for language. Now, at that very initial stage, we can make sense of things to a certain degree merely through the use of sanya, which has learnt from experience how to interpret things. So, for example, sanya is what learns from experience what a wall looks like. And that's why we know that if we try to walk through a wall, we'll just end up getting bruised. Sanya is what trains an animal in the wild to recognize friend from foe, to recognize food from not food, to distinguish danger from safety. And these are all survival mechanisms which are trained through the usage of sanya. But sanya in that sense, in an instinctive sense, is still quite immediate, even though it's trained from our experience of the past, but it's not yet able to reflect on the past and the future in any conscious way. And our ability to reflect on the past and future is dependent on the use of language, which is another step in the evolution of consciousness. Now, one of the most profound statements that the Buddha made was talking about this very point, and talking about the way that language interacts with consciousness. And he pointed out that we, in conscious, when we talk about something that was in the past, we use the word was. We talk about something in the future, we use the word will be. We talk about something in the present, we use the word is. What that means is that when we frame statements, whether in our mind or externally through language, that statement is already embedded in the past and the future. We can't say things without already implicating a concept of time in there. Now, this is something which is probably more true, or at least more obviously true, for Indic languages, which have a complex system of tenses, and so you always have to frame it in terms of present, past, and so on and so forth. Less true in the case of languages like Thai or Chinese, where these things are more optional. But nevertheless, the basic truth still applies, that in framing language, we are embedding ourselves in time. We're embedding our consciousness in time. And so when we talk about things, listen to that narrative that you're using in your mind. Yeah? When you're sitting in meditation, you're trying to make your mind quiet. What are you talking about? How you frame sentences in your mind to make sense of ideas to yourself, and those sentences have tenses. They have a referent which will point to the past or the present or the future through the use of tenses. So it's that use of language which is creating the notion of time within us. And of course, we assume that because we have words for something, that the thing itself must exist. Because our language is constantly programming us to think of the past and the future, therefore there must be a reality which is the past and the future. Actually, that's not the case. Actually, the case is that the reason why language is framed that way is because it's actually had a survival value. It can be understood purely in Darwinian terms. We actually have more survival value if we're able to project into the future and able to say, well, we've now found this bunch of bananas. I can only eat a dozen bananas right here and now. Let's take the other 50 bananas back to our cave and eat them tomorrow. And so as soon as we can phrase that in language, we're making a plan, and we can project that into the past and the future. And so this is from there. If we can do that for tomorrow, we can do it for next week, we can do it for next month, and we can do it for next year. And so now we come back full circle to the idea of what the meaning of New Year is. This festival, this time in the development of humanity, the development of consciousness, is very much bound up with this ability of people to grow crops, which is a seasonal thing, and it's the very basis of all of the civilization. The development of towns and cities are only possible because we're able to store food, and we're only able to store food in less technologically advanced societies because we can store grain effectively, because grain is the only thing that will last for such a long time without refrigeration. And so the development of growing grain in large quantities was developed through the understanding of yearly cycles. And that means that we have to do something very, very special to be able to do that. And this underlies that very development of consciousness. Something very special means that we throw away our most precious thing in order to support our survival in the future. We have the grain. We have that in our hands. It's nutritious, it's delicious, it's wonderful food. And we take that and we throw that on the ground as seed for the sake of next year's harvest. So this is where this idea of sacrifice comes in, that we don't eat everything we have. We toss that on the ground. We give it up. Because next year we can have that as food, and will give us even more food next year. So the idea that cause and effect, the idea of karma and vipaka, literally ripening action. Karma is the sowing, the action, the work of sowing the seed. The vipaka is the ripening of it. These things are embodied in the very language that we speak when we're talking about notions of death and rebirth in Buddhism, the karma and vipaka, or the notion of consciousness itself, vijnanam bijam. Consciousness is the seed. Kamang ketang, kama is the field of work, the field of action. Tanha sneho, craving is the moisture, the water, which enables that to come up, to grow. So the very notion of death and rebirth is fueled by this metaphor. The understanding of it is informed by this metaphor of the throwing away of the seed and the granting of new life. So again, this idea of the death being an essential passing away before the new life can come. We're seeing this on a grand scale now in our whole civilization. The survival of our civilization, or certainly the nature of the civilization that will survive in the future, is dependent on whether we can learn this basic lesson. Do we use all that we have now, or do we sacrifice now for the sake of the future? And while it was one great leap of consciousness to say, well, we'll sacrifice now to be able to have food in a year. And think about that. That's actually a remarkable thing. How many of us, even today, are able to think that far ahead? To think we will give up this now so that in 1 year's time we can have more. And certainly as a society, we're still very, very reluctant to do that. And this is what the basic problem of climate change and resource depletion is about. We can't stop ourselves from using now. And we can't bring ourselves to say we will sacrifice. Literal meaning of sacrifice, to make sacred. That's what sacrifice means. We will make sacred what there is now for the sake of the future. We will make that sacred. We will sacrifice it. We will make that tree, that ecosystem, those plants, those animals that are endangered. We will make that sacred. We will sacrifice the resources that we could have got through extracting and killing those things. We will sacrifice those things for the sake of greater benefit and happiness for all in the future. So this is the crux that we reach as a human species at this moment, is can we extend that insight which we developed so long ago as the foundations of our civilization and our culture? Have we evolved enough to be able to extend that insight to that next level and to let that guide us rather than the interests of the narrow sense self-interest at the present? This is our problem. So as meditators and as people practicing mindfulness and awareness in the present moment, we have a unique perspective on this thing, on this process. You know, we should not, and it's of course a grave mistake and in Buddhist practitioners that we tend to reify the present moment. Okay, this is what I call sometimes the narcissism of consciousness. That present moment awareness, which is an essential aspect of understanding the nature of our consciousness, the nature of awareness, the nature of existence, that is sometimes used and projected to mean, well, you don't think about the future, you don't reflect on the past, you don't plan things for the future, and you don't get involved and so on in the past and future. That's not what it means. Okay? Quite obviously, you can look at see what the Buddha did constantly in the threefold knowledge that he did. He was recollecting his past lives. Yeah, he wasn't in the present moment. He was thinking about the past, way back in the past. Yeah, and then the second knowledge is looking at how beings get reborn in the future. Yeah, and then when he was enlightened, he said he would not pass away before he'd established the fourfold sangha, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, and laywomen. He was already planning that when he became enlightened. So the past and the future, as a practical and an ethical reality, is just as important as it always has been. Of course, we still think about tomorrow. We still plan for things in the future. We still reflect on and learn from the past. That doesn't change. What changes is our understanding of the nature of what we're doing at that time. We have a better perspective, a more open perspective, which realizes that these things are not determined. We're not fixed by the past. So we have a Buddhist tradition and a Buddhist culture that informs our present, but it does not determine what we will do in the future. What determines what we do in the future is that choice. And choice is something that happens in the present moment. So the present is not merely something which is given to us. The present is something which in its most innermost nature is an ambiguity. The past has been combusted. The past is ashes. The future lies as an unexplored territory. It's uncreated. It's pure potential. And in this present moment, we have all of the fuel and the wisdom which has informed us from the past, and we have that spark within us which creates the future and that intention or that plan. And it's our choice here in that present moment as to what future we will create. It is our choice, and we must accept responsibility for that. It's not up to anybody else. It's not determined by the past. It's not determined by a tradition. It's not determined by a culture. It's informed by those things. It's informed by tradition, by the past, by the culture. It's informed by our past experience. But that spark, that cusp on the present moment, that in itself is potential. It's a capacity. And in our present moment, we choose to create what world we live in. So this is my talk for you this evening on New Year's Day, and I offer this to you for your reflection and amusement, and invite any comments or questions.
Swakato Bhagavata Dhammo. Amen.